From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. How many people are shot by police each year? As shootings involving police officers made headlines in recent years, that basic question spurred a years-long investigation by the Tampa Bay Times, resulting in what the paper calls Florida's most comprehensive database of police shootings. The numbers track more than 800 police shootings spread across nearly 400 law enforcement agencies across Florida, and they reveal startling statistics about race and how officers use force in our state. We'll speak with the reporter behind that investigation and a local representative from the NAACP of Collier County about those numbers in Southwest Florida. Plus, the manatee has enchanted people with its placid and unaggressive manner for years. The species has inspired countless groups of humans to rally for its protection, and now efforts are underway to reintroduce the sea cow to its native seas. We'll talk with the author of a new book entitled Manatees, Biology, Behavior, and Conservation about where this animal has been and what the future holds. But first, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. They're the antithesis of attractive, overweight, slow, unwieldy. They're drab, gray in color and often accumulate algae, barnacles, and other living things on their backs. Still, the manatee is one of Florida's more lovable sea animals. Later on the show today, we'll talk with a man who has studied them his whole life and who has recently published a book on the subject, which is filled with stunning pictures. We'll talk with Dr. John E. Reynolds III a little later in the show. But first, since 2014, the Tampa Bay Times has been compiling what it calls Florida's most comprehensive database of police shootings. Data from nearly 400 law enforcement agencies across Florida, tracked from 2009 to 2014, reveal startling statistics about how police use force, how interactions between officers begin, and how they can escalate, and what happens to the people who are shot. The data shows who was shot fleeing a crime scene, who was shot after pointing a weapon at an officer, and other valuable details. But the data also reveals troubling findings about race. Joining us to talk about this investigation is Ben Montgomery, who's a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times who led the investigative series called Why Cops Shoot. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks very much.
Also joining us today is Dr. Brandon Cooper with Collier County NAACP, sharing his perspective on what these numbers mean in Southwest Florida. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
We are talking about police shootings across Florida and what those numbers say about race and use of force in our state. Call in with your questions about the data and your thoughts on the issue at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Ben Montgomery with Tampa Bay Times, your reporting reveals some startling statistics about the number of police shootings in Florida, but let's start with the most basic numbers. On average, how many shootings are we seeing every year?
There were a total of 827 over the six-year period that we looked at, and that works out to roughly an average of 138, so about one every 2.5 days in the state.
So are those numbers changing year after year? Are they on a trend upward or downward?
No, they're pretty flat. And that was sort of a bit of a surprise to us. The proliferance lately of viral videos of police shootings have seemed to created this conversation, and we suspected that there was a bit of an uptick. It turns out there's not. The shootings have been pretty flat over the 6-year period of time, which admittedly is a relatively small period of time to take a look at.
Yeah, but it seems like the images are out there so much more that it seems I could see how you might have thought that they would have been going up.
This is what prompted us to take a look in the beginning, the shooting of Michael Brown, which created protests and sent people into the streets in Ferguson, Missouri. It blew me away after the fact. It blew me away that nobody keeps count of these things. I was just sort of outraged by that. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement can tell you how many purse snatchings there were, for instance, in 2008, but not how many times police officers fired at citizens. And so we decided because of that to try to take count for the very first time across the state, every shooting we could possibly track.
So officially within the state, there's nobody actually keeping track of these. So you decided to take it upon yourself. Now, how did you find that data? Did you have to go to every sheriff's department and police department and request information?
every single department. I sent an email in September of 2014, what we call a records request, to 388 law enforcement agencies in the state, from the smallest to the largest, asking for any paper generated when an officer fired a gun and somebody was injured or killed by that bullet. And the responsive documents, because there's no standard record keeping, there's no reporting mechanism that's the same agency to agency, the responding documents were varied. Some were a page, some were a list of names. Others ran, you know, over 100 pages with detailed reports and analysis and drawings. So we began to collect all that data, and we thought once it started coming in, and this is all public information, but once it started to coming in from the various agencies, we saw an opportunity to maybe learn something from the numbers, not just to take count, but to create a database that accounts for the demographics of the police and the demographics of those who were shot by the police. And then beyond that, situational information. Did the shooting start with a traffic stop? Did it involve a foot pursuit? Was it an undercover drug deal? So that we could see what trends existed in these shootings.
And you said that it was kind of sparked by curiosity about what's going on in Florida because of the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. What did your data end up revealing about race once you got it all?
Interestingly, about 40% of people shot by police in the 6-year period of time that we looked at were black. Compares with about 16 or 17% of the Florida population. So that on its face is out of whack, and suggests that there's room to question that, to take a hard look at what's going on in the shootings. Beyond that, once you test for the situational information, we found that you're more likely to be shot if you're black while committing minor crimes, while, for instance, running from police, and also while unarmed. The unarmed percentage of folks who were shot were black. And these are all things that that we thought worthy of exploration.
Yeah, I remember I looked at the numbers, and it broke down to out of the 800-something, 342, I think, were black, and then 330-something were white. But then when you broke it down further to whether they were armed or unarmed, that was where the disparity got a lot greater.
Yeah, nearly a fifth of the people shot, 156, were unarmed. So that means they had no gun, no knife, no vehicle with which to drive at the officer. And half of that 156 were black. Again, in a state where blacks make up about 15-16% of the population. So that means that unarmed black people were nearly 8 times as likely to be shot by police than whites.
So I want to turn now to Dr. Brandon Cooper with the Collier County NAACP. Just first, for people who aren't familiar, can you give me a quick headliner on what NAACP focuses on for people who aren't familiar?
Yes, the NAACP is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. It is a civil rights organization in the United States formed in 1909 as a biracial organization to advance justice for African Americans. But not just for African Americans, we focus on equal treatment of all people. So our primary focus is to help everyone to be treated fairly and equally.
So you've had a chance to review some of Ben's reporting. How do you and an organization like the NAACP take this kind of information?
It's very disheartening. For a million different reasons, but for the most reason is that there is at least a perception in the statistics that people are being treated differently because of the color of their skin and not because of who they are or what they did. And I think that also in using these statistics and also comparing them to some of the national statistics in terms of the African-American representation in the judicial branch, you know, we're at a national, the United States of America, there are 9% of African-American prosecutors. There are about roughly 20% of African-Americans on the police force. And that number for judges is also very similar, a very disparaging number at a 16% African-American judges across the nation. All of those things hurt when you're dealing with the criminal justice system as a whole.
Tell me a little bit about how you see the relationship between African-American communities in Southwest Florida and law enforcement.
I think it's a working relationship. There's definitely respect in Collier County and in Lee County. I've seen people trying to work together to stop some of these numbers. I think that now we're in the digital age and everybody has a cell phone and people can at any time go Facebook Live, Snapchat, can do all of these different things. These problems are not problems that just started happening. These have been happening for years and years, decades. Rodney King was 1991. But now you have to be able to hold people accountable.
Yeah, and those videos do keep people, you know, accountable.
They keep people very honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, fairly. I mean, but then sometimes they end up going through the judicial system and it ends up not being as it turns out. Those aren't always all of the facts, but it does definitely make people more self-aware, especially when they're being videotaped. So Ben Montgomery with Tampa Bay Times, the database is really extensive. It's searchable by county. And for the person who was shot, you can search race, mental status, threat level. And for the officer, you can search by the agency and even the reasons for interaction. Why was it so important to have such a detailed database for this story?
Very simply, we wanted to see if there were any trends in the state. We wanted to see if there were police departments who were shooting people at a greater rate, higher than other police departments. We also wanted to see if there were certain situations that were more likely to result in police shootings. And ultimately to suss out the shootings that we and experts felt were preventable, to try to draw some lessons from them. How could these things have gone down in a less violent manner?
So what do you mean by preventable?
Well, preventable in the sense that everybody goes home safely. Was there a way in the decisions the officer made leading up to the moment the gun was fired, was there a way to reduce the chance of anybody being in danger, including the officer, because we're obviously concerned with officer safety as well? Could the officer have made different decisions to prevent the shooting on the front end? And we wound up talking for a long while with the chief of police in Daytona Beach for the past 10 years, Mike Chitwood, who is now, as of November, he's been elected the sheriff of Volusia County. And Chitwood belongs to an organization called PERF, the Police Executive Research Forum, that spent a lot of time looking at, over the past 2 or 3 years, looking at use of force. And they've come up with a list of suggestions and ways that police agencies might reduce the chances of having to use fatal force. And it's very kind of like the first five or six are super common sense. Never fire into a moving vehicle. You're more likely to, if you kill the driver, create a 3,000-pound unguided missile, for instance. So they encourage agencies to adopt policies that prohibit the shooting into cars. And beyond that, like Chitwood says, slow down. He tells his officers this, slow down. When you get that information from the dispatcher, that early information, it's not sometimes wrong. It's not half the times wrong. It's always wrong. And so if you're flying in at 100 miles an hour into a situation with wrong information, you're going to make a bad decision. So he says, slow down, take an extra 30 seconds. And we asked the police do an incredibly dangerous job. We asked them to put themselves in harm's way time and time again. But it's the opinion of some of these experts who've looked at these things to slow down, take more time, create time and distance. Don't put yourself in harm's way. And everybody, this ups the chances of everybody going, of the arrest being made and everybody going home safely at the end of the day.
That's a good point, that first call. There are a couple levels of perception that happen between somebody calling and reporting it, the dispatcher getting through the radio, all that. We are talking about police shootings across Florida and what those numbers say about race and use of force in our state. You can call in with your questions about the data and your thoughts on the issue at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So in the course of your reporting, and as you just mentioned, you worked a lot with Police Chief Mike Chitwood, and he's now the sheriff, as you mentioned, of Volusia County. He says the nature of policing has changed significantly in recent years. So let's listen to a piece of that interview, which was taken from your work with the radio show and podcast Radiolab.
Today, for some reason, we've switched out of the guardian mentality, and we've become warriors. And that's not what American policing was founded on. The key with the use of force anywhere is proportionality. Would you use an elephant gun to kill a flea? The challenges are always we are human beings, and sometimes we're asked to make a split-second decision, and sometimes we could be wrong. Unfortunately, those things are going to happen. The question is, how much do we mitigate them? And the way to mitigate them is through a philosophy in your department that the sanctity of human life comes first. We talked about proportionality. You talk about rendering first aid. I mean, you know, we are held to a higher standard for a reason. It's kind of difficult, and I know this having been involved in two police shootings, it's kind of difficult to have somebody fire at you from point-blank range and you shoot him, and then you want to turn a switch off and try to do everything you can to save his life. But you know what? That's what we're required to do. Body cameras was huge for us. We were the first police department in the state of Florida to go live with the body camera program. We have 150 of them out there. Complaints against police have plummeted. We probably have plummeted by 75%. That's the good news. The bad news is, for a police administrator, be prepared for the downside. You're going to see things on that camera that are going to cause you to take pause and look back at how you're trained and whether or not that officer needs to belong in the organization anymore.
That was Police Chief Mike Chitwood, who is now the sheriff of Volusia County. And I want to ask Dr. Brandon Cooper with the Collier County NAACP. You've lobbied with the National Bar Association for body cam legislation in the state of Florida. Do you see those efforts having success?
I think that the conversation is ever going. It's an on-lasting conversation. When you talk about body cameras, dash cams, you talk about the positioning. When is an officer authorized to turn their body camera on and off? There are several different elements and components to body cam legislation besides actually just getting officers to have the camera on their shoulder. And I do think that those efforts are being successful. We've had the Legislative Black Caucus. We've had tons of support from them. And we're trying to craft bills so that not only are they wearing their body cams, they're actually using them. They're not turning them off as soon as they enforce and then stop.
Well, that's an option for people to turn them off?
Well, you know, police officers, sometimes they make decisions. They make decisions to turn their body cameras on. They make decisions to turn their body cameras off. And it kind of just depends on that particular police officer, what he's going to do in that moment. But he has the ability to reach on his shoulder and turn the body camera right off.
So, Ben, I wanted to ask you mentioned earlier that with all the different data, you wanted to see if there are any correlations or any trends in different counties. Are you seeing that other police departments or sheriff's offices are taking the same kind of approaches as Chitwood is to using body cameras and training?
Oh, sure. There are a number of police departments that have put in place the, you know, any number of the guiding principles suggested by PERF. In Florida, the Miami Beach PD, I know, has put in place a handful, and Palm Beach County is a sheriff's office as well. And a lot of agencies have in place already some of these policies, particularly the don't fire into vehicles policy. It seems like that is more and more widely accepted. You know, and that first came into play, so far as I was able to tell, in the early 70s, 1972, in New York City, when they had this high rate of police shootings, and it was primarily because they were shooting into vehicles. And once that policy went into place, the number of police shootings plummeted. So it's very clear, clearly established policy that helps keep people safe.
And a large part of this is the retraining. And I wanted to stay with Chief Mike Chitwood for a moment, now Sheriff, and use an example again from the Radiolab podcast about how the kind of training he instituted in Miami, Daytona Beach, can mm-hmm. lead to better outcomes.
So video starts in silence, and it's a body cam video. It's a body cam on the cop who is driving a squad car.
He's got his body cameras mounted to his eye.
On his glasses.
So the camera's going where his eyes go.
Next to him, passenger side, is his partner. Both cops are white. Also, it's night.
So the call is for a guy who's running around with a knife trying to stab people. He was off his meds. I think he was on a crack cocaine binge, if I remember correctly. They park.
It's a little neighborhood street, and you can see down the street.
Half a block away.
No, man.
This shirtless black guy.
Why don't you chill out, Derek?
That's the cop talking to him, the cop wearing the body cam. And this black man,
he's got his arm raised,
pretty big knife in his hand, and he's walking towards the cops.
Why don't you stop acting so crazy?
The black guy gets closer and closer and closer, and finally the cop wearing the body cam pulls out
a taser.
The other officer
who's out of the frame is behind him with his firearm out. And the guy,
what your like, hey, put it down,
is approaching.
What, you're not, put the knife down. Right, put it down.
And he gets within like 10 feet of the cops, and then
taser.
The guy with the body cam fires the taser. The guy holding the knife, he falls onto his back onto this like cement driveway. He's still got the knife in his hand.
Put it down, or you're gonna get it again.
And the cop who's got his gun out, he hustles over, kicks the knife out of the guy's hand, grabs him by the hand, turns him over, and then
he's detained Central Code 4.
Cuffs him.
And then,
hey Derek, man, it's not a smart idea to have a knife coming at the police.
The officer will say, why didn't you listen to me and just drop the knife and walk toward me? Why did you keep coming at me?
You're real lucky you didn't get shot.
I wanted to. I was trying my best.
You were trying your best to get shot?
I want to see if I can get it.
You want to die?
I want to see if I can.
You want to die?
I can't.
Huh?
I can't.
You can't die.
He tells the officer, goes, I'm Jesus Christ, and I want everybody to know the police bullets can't kill me.
Well, sure. I mean, I know you can't.
All right, Derek. We're going to stand up, all right?
That was from the Radiolab podcast produced from the reporting Why Cops Shoot. And Dr. Brendan Cooper with the Collier County NAACP, how do you feel hearing that tape? Would you consider that a successful de-escalation?
Very successful de-escalation. There was no loss of life, and there were no extra injuries to the police officers while trying to maintain the sanctity of life.
Yeah, and Ben, speaking of injuries to officers also, I think my producer mentioned that you have a story about a police officer who became injured just in trying to avoid injuring someone.
That's not ringing a bell to me. I'm not sure where that came from. There are, I'm sure, many stories like that, but that doesn't come up in the story that we wrote.
Brandon?
Police officers, and I have several friends, several family members that are officers in law enforcement. The prime objective for any officer is to make it home to their children, to their families, to all of their friends and the people that they care about. And the mentality that they have walking into any situation is always survival and instinct. It's very, very hard for you to prioritize making it home versus de-escalating a situation. So sometimes police officers are tasked with trying to do their job, but also trying to fight those basic human instincts. It's a very difficult thing to do, being placed in those different situations. And, you know, there are some amazing police officers out there that do that every day, that will go that extra mile to ensure that nobody else is hurt or dies that doesn't need to, that they can make it home to their families as well.
Mm-hmm. And Ben Montgomery, much of the narrative around officers involved in shootings seems to polarize between two extremes, an officer faced with a terrible choice or the crooked cop stereotype of someone who's disproportionately involved in violence and shootings. Did your investigation reveal anything to support either one of these, you know, stereotypes?
Interestingly, we found a couple of off-duty shootings that were sort of domestic violence incidents. In one case, a female detention deputy shot her estranged boyfriend, things like that. When we looked at, and we filtered out those sorts of things. But when you look at on-duty shootings, we did not find a single case of a cop who set out with the intention of killing someone. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't clear, unless the reports had been like gigantically manipulated in a way that we couldn't figure out. These shootings occur with police trying to do the right thing. By and large, police are going into situations that oftentimes are dangerous with the intention of doing the right thing. The last shooting that we write about in this story, which played out in unincorporated St. John's County, the shooting of Andrea Sheldon, is sort of an example of this. There are four or five cops headed toward a house where they have received a call about a possible suicidal person, and they think they're getting into the middle of a domestic issue. because of bad information coming into them through dispatch, they are led to believe that the man in this domestic situation might be hallucinating. He might be hiding in the woods. They're led to believe that the woman has chased him into the woods with a gun, when the fact was the man was 4 miles away, drunk as Cooter Brown and laying on the hood of his truck, and the woman was asleep in her bed. But these officers going into this situation with this bad information, you know, no fault of their own, think they're headed into hostile territory and wind up shooting a woman who stepped onto her front porch with a shotgun because she lived in the rural part of Florida and she thought, you know, maybe she heard somebody outside. There's no indication that she had any reason whatsoever to believe that the police were showing up at her house. So it's like cases like this where, you know, it's the police headed into a situation trying to do what's right, and because of either bad information coming into them or bad training or bad decisions on the front end, life is lost. And it's those shootings that we thought there's room here for improvement. And let's start a conversation about these.
Dr. Cooper, you had a comment?
I think the perspective of the NAACP when we see things like this is to prove the negative stereotyping and the stigmas surrounded by African Americans wrong. He said misinformation. A lot of people, what goes along with misinformation is when you pull up on a scene and you do see a black man or you do see a black woman, you may have a perception based on TV or music or whatever, who that person is, what they stand for. And you may approach a situation differently than if you saw a white person or if you saw a Mexican person or a Spanish person or any other racial stereotype. Many African-American attorneys face this all the time. As high as we are in the legal profession and being friends of the court, sometimes we walk into court and people think we're the defendant. They don't understand that we're actually the counsel. You know, there are times I've had conversations with people. I say, "Oh, I'm about to go to court," and they say, "Oh, what'd you do?" And I'm just like, "No, that's not why I go to court. I go to court to do a job." And so I think sometimes
that kind of perception creates that same type of misinformation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. We have a call coming in from George in Port Charlotte. George, you've been pretty patient. What would you like to say?
First of all, good afternoon to everyone.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I'd like to know, since we're talking about stigmas, what about the fact that I think some people view things differently because they look at numbers. What about the male population of black people in the United States is roughly 8%, but yet the black population in the prison system is almost 75% or 80%. So what do you attribute such a disproportional number? Is it that blacks commit more crimes? Or, you know, so I don't know. What do you have? So I'm going to hang up, and I'd like to hear your answer.
That'll probably be a multi-layered answer from Dr. Brandon Cooper.
Okay, so you have a lot of different things going on when you're talking about the prison population. A lot of sometimes seemingly minorities, they're not necessarily educated on their legal rights. Maybe they didn't hire an attorney. Maybe they didn't seek legal representation. Maybe they cut a deal. A lot of those things go into it. Then also the poverty and the disparities there. Some people, you know, they commit crimes, but they're committing crimes because they don't see another means of escape. They don't have a job. They can't function. They can't feed their children. There are a lot of different reasons to the prison population. But another part of that is some of those reasons are that a lot of people get bad deals. A lot of people, because of their race, are put in situations where, you know, a judge or a prosecutor who is already misrepresented, as who does not understand necessarily where those people are coming from, are going to throw the book at them instead of giving them a chance to rehabilitate themselves.
And Ben Montgomery, with your Tampa Bay Times reporting, did you notice that perception and giving bad information to police officers possibly contributing to the racial disparity in the people that were shot during the study?
It's really hard to say. That's a there were some focus groups held again by this organization, PERF, Police Executive Research Forum, and they brought in a bunch of officers and a bunch of civilians and asked them a series of questions. And some of the questions centered around perceptions of racism and ingrained bias. And the interesting thing they learned from that was the white officers felt like, the black citizens felt like there was definitely bias in the police ranks. The white officers felt like there was no bias in the police ranks. And the interesting thing that occurred was minority officers wound up speaking up during these focus groups and talking about their own experience dealing with police. Now, these are police officers who are black and Latino, who are speaking of their experience dealing with the police and suggesting that, in fact, there is a problem. And this caught the white officers off guard. They were interested to hear their colleagues say, yeah, no, we confirm the experience of the citizens. So that doesn't speak, in my mind, to malevolence. It speaks more to a sort of ingrained institutional racism that is really, really, really difficult to address, especially if you try to do that when looking at situations that involve police shootings. And to just spend a half a second addressing the question about the 75% of the population in American prisons being black, there's a really interesting documentary making the rounds now called 13th that I'd suggest the caller check out. But it essentially explores the idea that, that the blacks in the U.S. have been subject to 250 years of slavery, followed by 90 years of Jim Crow and 60 years of separate but equal and 35 years of racist housing policy. And these are contributing factors to the fact that our prisons are filled predominantly with black men.
And I wanted to ask you a different question. Of the more than 820 people that were shot in this database, you found that more than 240 people showed signs of mental instability. What does that term mental instability mean when the police write that into a report?
We didn't take that lightly. These were cases in which the person was known to have been diagnosed with a mental illness. So whether that was noted by the police or by a family member in subsequent media coverage, we were looking for people who had specifically before the shooting been diagnosed with mental illness.
That doesn't apply to people that are out of it on drugs or anything like that?
No. They were filtered out.
And that mental instability, that heading, I guess, is that further broken down by race?
It is, and I don't have that number in front of me right now.
I'm just curious.
I apologize. Yeah. You can look at the database at TampaBay.com and explore case by case all of those various categories.
And is there any way to extrapolate also people who are intending to be shot by the police officer? Because in that piece of sound, the guy said, I wanted you to shoot me because I wanted to prove that you couldn't kill me. Is there a connection to suicide by cop?
Yeah, sure enough, there is. And interestingly, about 80% of the people shot in what we dubbed suicide by cop were white. And in order for us to categorize a shooting as suicide by cop, the person had to indicate to someone else that he wanted the police to take his life. And then perform a set of behavior to prompt the police to shoot him or her. And so, interestingly, 80%, I don't know why that is, 80% of those involved in suicide by cops were white.
That's really interesting. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now because we've run up against time, but I want to thank so much Ben Montgomery, Tampa Bay Times staff writer, for telling us about your research into this topic. Really great story. And also thank you to Dr. Brandon Cooper, legal counsel with the Collier County NAACP.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the time and explaining a lot of this out because, numbers are numbers, but having some words to back it up and round it out makes a difference.
Sure.
Coming up, you rarely get to see much more than their nostrils poking through the surface of the water, but manatees have a beguiling presence that is hard to deny. Dr. John Reynolds has recently released a book on this roly-poly subject. We will talk with him right after this.